on hereditary evil. This once again is another area where the writings and the new church depart.
I'm telling you,
from traditional Christian teaching. Okay, but I want to actually start off by talking about hereditary. Hereditary is both internal and external. Now, we know that hereditary is part of the way we are created. The body inherits the traits of the parents in a very specific way, which can be described by science. What happens is that the egg, which is in the woman, is fertilized by the sperm, which is in the male, and they combine together. Now, this is not a sex education lesson, obviously. Hopefully you will all have done that at some stage in your life. But what is really interesting is that you see here that the egg is external and the sperm is internal. It goes into the egg. And what is actually happening is that the egg contains 23 genes, and the sperm contains 23 genes, and every cell in the human body requires 46 genes.
Chromosomes.
And so you finish up with a fertilized egg, I think it's known as a zygote, with the correct number of chromosomes. And then that egg begins to split and creates a new organism. In the cell,
could we whip the lights off?
Yeah.
Here it's tending to dumb down.
Just there.
Dumb the picture down.
Bottom right.
Okay.
So you have an egg which creates the external and the sperm which creates the internal. Now, in modern science, we have learned a lot more about genetics. We've got to the stage now where we can actually use genetics in all sorts of interesting ways to map where people come from through history. And we do this through two main methods. One method is looking at the Y chromosome. Is looking at the Y chromosome, which only the male in the species possesses. And the other method is looking at a special, actual separate chromosome within the cell that remains unchanged. Now, the interesting thing about the Y chromosome is that it doesn't get mixed up in a way that the X chromosome does, partly because it's a completely different shape and size. And so science can actually use the Y chromosome to go back through history. They can recognize the very small variations that take place over thousands of years and actually use that on a map by testing individual males in various places around the world. They can actually connect them up to where they came from. It's quite a complex science. So that's called Y chromosome genetic archaeology. But there is, in fact, another form of archaeology. Hang on a second. It is, in fact, another form of archaeology called mitochondrial archaeology. And that's based on the idea that these organelles in the cell actually have their own short section of chromosome, genetic material. And these cells actually work through the female line because, of course, they exist in the egg. And there is one that exists in the sperm as well, but when the sperm deposits its genetic material into the egg, the mitochondria in the sperm is left behind. So that we know that these mitochondria actually come all the way back through the female line, through all of the eggs that have been created in the female body, going all the way back. And this has allowed scientists to talk in terms of the Eve theory, the original mother. And in fact, it is quite surprising that they estimate that around 80 to 100,000 years ago, 20 and 100 or so individuals left North Africa. And amongst those individuals, there were a whole group of related females. They were sisters or mothers and daughters or whatever. And every single person on the face of the earth outside of Africa is inherited, is descendant from that tiny group. And they know this because down through the generations, over those hundreds of thousands of years, these mitochondria have been preserved and their genetic material within them. Although there is a very small variation, which is quite useful because that can actually help them to distinguish where about more recent people that bear that variation have come from other places in the Earth, more recent history. Now, I did have a beautiful map that showed you the tracks. Unfortunately, fate being what it is, it's not on there. Don't ask me how, but anyway, it's not. So I'm sorry about that. But the point that I wanted to make is that even in this situation, you have the internal Y-DNA, which scientists use to track the male line, and an external female DNA. So I just thought that was a really interesting correspondence, if you like, talking about heredity, because that's what we're going to go on to talk about.
Can now. I say one thing, Martin?
Yeah.
That is, I've come more and more to realise that when you use the word internal or external, I'm not being Swedenborgian now, just being cultural, internal seems to imply better. External seems to imply not as better in people's minds generally, which I think, and I don't want to go into this, I think it actually is one of the sources of gender difficulties. Whereas I think internal and external are absolutely equally important. And once you realise that, you don't put a value difference on either of them. But they're just there. Okay? And I think that's essential to hammer home when you talk about male internal, female X.
Yep. And I can see the expressions on some of the women in the room, and I know what they're thinking.
Yeah, I had some of that, but I will also ask you to clarify some of the science, because I guess I thought the mitochondrial was really internal. It was in the cell nucleus, and
no.
The Y was outside of it, but no, I had that wrong.
The Y is the XY chromosome is in the centre of the nucleus, that makes it a male offspring. So the central nucleus, which contains those, what is it, 46 chromosomes, either is XX or XY.
What's mitochondrial RNA actually?
The mitochondrial has RNA in it, but it's outside of the nucleus. It is actually, the mitochondrial is actually called the power pack.
That's why I thought it was in.
No.
That's why I wasn't sure about the internal, external, being precise about the science.
So it is actually. Are you challenging me? What does it mean? We're going to get to that.
If you're going to build theology on it, that's what I'm saying.
You need to be sure that you're talking.
Are you sure, yeah?
Yeah.
But,
I don't have internet access here to check out your science, but I'll go
anyway. As we let you say, go away and look it up. Check it out.
But if you leave her behind at this point, her mind will be on that the whole thing.
Well, else, the mitochondria is in the cytoplasm.
See?
But what?
The mitochondria is in the cytoplasm.
Yeah, that's what I'm used to, but your question has raised a question in me as to how the nucleus gets its energy, because the mitochondria supplies the energy to the whole cell. So I'm going to be looking to see if the mitochondria is in the nucleus as well, because for the nucleus to do its work of dividing, it needs energy to do it. To do anything. So
it's transported through chemical energy through the cytoplasm.
Well, if you're glad you're looking up the cell, have a look at some of the incredible videos. Of course, we can't really see inside the cell, but there have been incredible videos that have been made of the processes taking place inside cells. And there's actually things like monorails. I kid you not, monorails inside a cell with huge, what they call organelles, various parts of the cell traveling along them, carrying the various energy packs and the various supplies and requirements. The cell is like a city in its complexity. It's so vast and so complex. Fascinating. Okay, so we have. That's external hereditary, and we can basically build our science around that. It's so solid, as I say, that it's able to be used to overturn a lot of other archaeological techniques. They refer to ancient or prehistory archaeology, the proofs of prehistory archaeology, as stones, bones, tones and genes. Stones are obviously the rock paintings and any buildings, not many, that exist from that time. Bones obviously are ancient skulls and skeletons. Tones are the use of language and then the way language has devolved and changed, but yet it belongs to families. And obviously genes is the latest one, but genes seem to be so solid scientific proof that they can actually overturn the ideas of all the other three. And so in the last 20 years we've had a fascinating rewriting of the history of where we came from. And just as a little, this is all a little bit of a detour, but just out of interest, one of the big things that has come out is that we began in North Africa in what's called the Rift Valley, which is Ethiopia, just below Egypt, about 100,000 years ago. What had happened was that the world was enduring an ice age at that time, and so the whole of Europe was in fact under ice. So it couldn't be settled. But what had happened was that the sea levels had dropped to such a point where the
access,
but what's the big Egyptian running between
Suez?
Not just Suez, but the Big Bay.
Persian Gulf.
The Persian Gulf. The Persian Gulf had actually sunk down so far that it could actually be crossed. And so these groups left Africa and crossed the Persian Gulf into the southern part of the Middle East.
A bit like crossing the Red Sea, isn't it?
Yeah, well, someone else would have called it a kind of a Stargate, you know, this access port. Yeah.
How do they know it's Africa?
Because that's where the earliest genetic variation exists, basically. So they can trace that, even though the variation was very slow, something like only 10 or 20,000 years between variations, that gives them the chance to actually measure that. And they're in the process now of basically virtually making a record of the genetic material of every individual nation and culture and people on Earth, so that they will get to the stage where they have a database where they'll be able to say, well, that's your genetic. And at the same time, they've reduced the cost of getting your own genetic imprint from, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to around $6,000. It's another side story that the wife of one of the founders of Google has actually developed one of the most cutting-edge genetic reading labs in America. And you can just send her a bit of a cotton bud inside of your mouth in a tube, just post it to them, and for about $4,000 or $5,000, they'll not only post you back your genetic imprint, but they will tell you any possible diseases that you might be prone to, where your ancestors came from, you know, all of these incredible things, such as the technology at this stage.
All we now need to do is just map the diseases with the spiritual,
That's
conflicts
right.
that you might have.
And that's good, and I'm glad you mentioned that, Cole, because one of the aims in this talk that I want to give is to try to tie your thinking together between the two, to show you that even as science expands our understanding of such elite things like our genetic material, it remains in sync with some of the spiritual things that Swedenborg wrote about in the writings. But let me just finish what I was going to say. One of the interesting things that's come out of genetic archaeology is that the first major civilizations were actually in India and China. So around 60 to 80,000 years ago, mankind traveled from Africa, built major civilizations in China, major civilizations in India, major civilizations in China, and even came as far as Australia. So Australia has some of the oldest genetic material in the world, around 60,000 years old. I wish I had the map, because that's the way they travelled. They basically travelled out of Africa, round through India, round through Southeast Asia, up into China, and came down into Australia. Okay. So that's really interesting, and that in itself... Sorry.
Oh. I just wanted to ask, because the actual physical features of these cultures are just so diverse, so different.
They don't know why Chinese look so different, for example, from Europeans or Asians in general. They do know that there's a very clear connection facially. I'll get to you a second. There's a clear connection facially between Chinese and American Indians, and they can now trace the route. The route went across China, up through Alaska, and across the Straits, the Bering Straits, and into America.
It's just on that, Martin, about facial appearance. I read the reason that Asians look sort of slitty-eyed, it's a local development, which is an extra layer of skin that covers... It's there to protect the eye against the cold winds that sweep across Asia and Mongolia.
Yep. certainly.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that like there was just a small number of people.
That's practice.
And, you know, different individuals have slightly different variations even within a family, but like when they got separated, that particular characteristic became quite. So maybe somebody had a slip that was protective against the wind, so then they were like, and it's just, you know, because if you look at within your own family group, you'll see like maybe like my brother's kids all have this particular characteristic and my sister's done.
Because skin colour doesn't change.
Right, but that's just sort of like over the middle of millennia, like certain characters, and that's an explanation I
And then it stayed.
Because they're now they're an isolated population, so they keep passing on that gene for that one slight little variation.
Katie, did you want to say something?
No, I didn't.
Just want me to keep going. What gets really exciting, and I'll just finish on this. I'm sorry, Katie, but I'll just finish on this. What gets really exciting is now they know why in Tibet they have large golden cats as part of their religious ceremonies. And the Aztecs and the Incas also use these large golden hats. And in fact, in Hawaii, they also use these golden hats. And they now know why. Because they know that those peoples actually came out of central China, all of them, and some of them moved across to Tibet, and others moved up and around. And in fact, the Pacific Islanders, the Polynesians, came originally from the south coast of Canada, caught boats across the Pacific to the islands. And you have a very distinct difference between Polynesians and what I believe are called Melanesians, which came through Indonesia and from that direction. And it's all very interesting.
Would I like to have been in the head of those people and wouldn't think, oh yeah, let me get a tiny boat on this massive ocean and go for days, that's a good idea.
Maybe get laid.
Sorry?
Maybe get laid.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
Okay, so let's look at the writings discussion of hereditary. Internal hereditary. The first thing we find about internal hereditary is that sin, or inherited evil, did not come from Adam. Okay, the vast bulk of the Christian church today believes that Adam sinned and therefore we are all stuck with it. Alright, it was just kind of a universal thing that happened and we were all stuck with that sin. Secondly, the writings teach us that inherited evil is not true evil, but it is a tendency to evil. Everyone who by his own actions commits sin consequently acquires a certain disposition, and the evil arising from it is implanted in his children and becomes hereditary. Thus, what a person inherits from either parent, from his grandparent, hereditary evil. No? What am I doing?
Comes from the father, doesn't it? Wait, where does it say that?
I actually think the word tendency is one of the most important spiritual terms there is. It takes it away from you to be a general inclination. And I think there's all the difference in the world, and it ends with guilt.
You don't own it until you own it.
Okay, from TCR 521, hereditary evil comes from no other source but one's parents, and it is not real evil that one actually commits, but a tendency to it. That is something anyone would acknowledge, provided he applied his powers of reasoning to his experience. Everyone knows that children have by birth a general likeness to their parents in their faces, their behaviour and their characteristics, and grandchildren and great-grandchildren too show the same resemblance to their grandfathers and great-grandfathers. Many people can tell families apart by this, and even races. And if you were able to perceive the life sphere radiating from anyone's inherent nature, you could likewise be convinced of the similarity of their temperaments and minds. So while we inherit evil from our parents, it is a different kind of evil to the evil we actually do. And therefore, we are not responsible. We are not held accountable for that evil. Point number three. We are not punished for evil we have inherited. It should be realized, Arcana 966, it should be realized that nobody in the next life undergoes any punishment and torment on the account of evil he has inherited, but only on the account of evils he himself has actually committed. So there's a difference.
There's a very good biblical passage, I think it's in Ezekiel, it could be in Isaiah, a couple of chapters, which brings out the sins of the children and not the sins, the sins of the fathers and not of the children.
Yeah.
And it's very much like that idea.
Yeah, that's right. And he usually quotes that verse. At one point, you have said, the sins of the fathers shall be visited on the children to the third and fourth generation.
Mm-hmm. It's exactly the same as we were saying yesterday. And, you know, Elizabeth, you were talking about the experience with the knife.
Mm.
You didn't do it.
Mm.
You know,
mm.
It's but the same
if,
thing.
If my inheritance was that all arguments are solved by knifing someone, then I think that's the norm. So I inherit that thought. But it's not till I actually do it that have committed an evil. So I have to rethink my inherited patterns and habits of my parents.
And they will likely present themselves at the forefront of your mind. I imagine that's the tendency. It presents itself to you, and you may well feel drawn to it, perhaps more strongly than other things. But then that presentation then is the choice you then have.
Mm. Is that what we're getting in the Middle East? You hated that person, so I'm your son, so therefore I have to hate that person too. Is that sort of along the same lines?
You know what? This is what I think. I think that, and I'll go on to talk about the ways of reducing the inherited evil that we pass on to our children. What I think is that in the West, we have had an opportunity to actually begin to fight against the inherited evil that is passing on to our children and actually reduce, as it were, the flow of that taking place. And that is what we actually call civilization. Okay? It's actually the reduction of extreme inherited evil being handed on to our children. Now, I think nations like the Middle East, because they have remained intact for so many, well, for thousands of years, really, they remain unchanged. They're still doing the same things that they were doing thousands of years ago. And that preservation of that culture has also preserved a level of inherited evil being passed on to their children, which has not been able to be stemmed. And I think they're coming to the stage now. And this is one of the ironies of conflict between East and West. Is that the generation now is beginning for the first time to counteract that vast ocean of inherited evil. And those are the ones that we're getting angry with. The ones that are doing all the work. Anyway, we'll keep going. Did you want to say something, Paul?
No.
Come on. Okay. All right, next, another interesting point about inherited evil. Inherited evil doesn't begin to show itself until a child grows up and acts from their own understanding and will. So the influence of inherited evil is, as it were, enclosed in innocence. And I mentioned a little of this yesterday. And until that innocence in adolescence begins to break up, a child, we can't see that inherited evil. We can't even really begin work out, you know, what that child, it's genetic material, if you like, it's a genetic evil, hasn't begun to show through. 4563. It is well known that a person derives evil from both parents and that this evil is called hereditary evil. He is therefore born with that evil, but it does not show itself until he grows up and acts from his understanding and his will, based on his understanding. In the meantime, it lies hidden, especially during early childhood. Now, because in the Lord's mercy, no one can come to be blamed for his hereditary evil, only for the evil of his own doing. And hereditary evil cannot become evil of his own doing until he acts from his own understanding and his own will. Young children are therefore guided by the Lord by means of young children and angels. It is for this reason that they are seen to live in a state of innocence, yet hereditary evil lies hidden within each particular thing that they do. So there the Lord provides in a miraculous way a kind of shield of innocence around them.
It's part of that equilibrium thing, isn't it? That's what I feel. It's always holy.
Yeah.
As you said yesterday.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, just to comment on that. Hereditary evils don't begin to show themselves until you have the cognitive ability to actually reflect and make a choice about what you're going to do. And that's how we regenerate.
It's a kind of an age of accountability, really, isn't it? And there's been lots and lots of arguments about when we reach that age of accountability. I guess it's in growth of the mind or something like that. I haven't really studied it closely.
Yeah, but it probably goes on to...
But the thing you have to remember about Swedenborg's, what Swedenborg, when Swedenborg talks about the growth of a human being, is that...
It's mine, it's only going to ring twice.
Okay. You're really dealing with correspondences even when you're talking about physical growth and spiritual growth running side by side. So I personally believe that you can have innocence lasting well into young adulthood in some circumstances. And then, you know, by the same token, the regeneration process can start in late adulthood or even old age. But you can still apply a lot of the things that Swedenborg talked about natural growth. Because, of course, all of these things are based on the Lord's life, which underwent, as it were, the perfect meshing of natural physical growth and spiritual growth together. Okay, another thing about inherited evil. Inherited evil is not only acquired from our grandparents and great-great-grandparents, ancestors, but it can be added to and passed on to our children. 313. Everyone who by his own actions commits sin consequently acquires a certain disposition, and the evil arising from it is implanted into his children and becomes hereditary. So
I actually follow in the accumulative theme of Swedenborg's view of heredity to be far more scary than the idea of original sin. Much more in our court to take responsibility and deal with it and realise I can actually pass on good and pass on so much bad.
And that's probably for myself, that's probably the biggest thing, being a father and knowing writings that has come together in my own mind. How much of the evil that, you know, is kind of too small to really worry about, you know, am I actually adding to the evil that I've inherited, making it harder for my kids? But, you know, that's just something that goes through my mind. Sorry, Kurt.
The way I understand this, and to me it adds up with, that adds into Swedenborg, what he's saying, but it's not, it wouldn't at first be apparent, is that our mind itself is just simply a data bank. And when we're born, we're blank.
But we have the gift of consciousness life, which to me is the Holy Spirit and comes from the Lord. But that's all we have. We're totally blank. And we have to first of all create neural pathways, even to move our hand to pick something up and learn how to do that. But the next things we start to create is our data bank. From experiencing our environment, we start making conclusions, and each conclusion is a piece of data. And this data becomes, in the end, our program. And in the end, we start to put hierarchies in the data and decide we create our own program. Now, how do things get passed on? In my programming, I'm saying things out of my mouth and doing things all the time because I can only speak and act and think from my program. It's impossible for me to do anything else. And that is automatically being fed into everyone around me, especially my children. They're seeing my actions. They are hearing my speech. And so it was back. My father and mother picked up from their parents and their grandparents. And to me, it's being passed through our speech and our actions via our data bank, which is actually our mind.
So it's kind of like a software.
It is exactly,
Or even a virus.
But what actually does the organising is the affection, and that you can't see. So data is organised by something higher that's coming in all the time, and so there's a spiritual component.
Yeah.
So we don't start...
Well, how I explain that is very simple too. The data, you've got to first create a mind, and to me that is Adam. Adam is mind. And then once you get this data, start to build up a data bank, and you might be 8, 9, 10, or even 12 years old, and you start to put hierarchies in your data. You make a decision of what is going to make your life great. And it might be if I have the perfect marriage. It might be if I have the best car on the street. And that is your leading love. That's the leading love. And that is, to me, Eve coming out of Adam. Adam is the mind, and Eve is the thing you've decided is going to make your life fantastic. And if somewhere along the line you get a block and you can't get there, there was a show recently on two actresses who starred as young girls. One became an actress, the other one failed. The one that couldn't become the actress, she thought the only way she was going to have a great life was to be an actress. And when she couldn't get there, she felt blocked, she went to drugs, she committed suicide. No one taught her to find another leading love. So to me, Eve is our leading love, which is the rudder which steers our whole ship. Our ship is our mind, our data bank, our program, all the data we've collected from every conclusion we've made. But it has to be steered with something, and that is our leading love, steering it. And we're passing it on to generation to generation. When you get into Arab countries, they've got so many violent ideas and false ideas against their neighbours or the other religion. They're just feeding it in language and actions down through the generations. We seem to, in the West, have conquered this. As you were saying before, we've looked at these things and we've thought, we can't keep fighting Catholic against Protestant. And we've reviewed it and thought, this is too crazy. And so we've actually changed our program around this area. We've thought, this is not a good program. And so we have learned, in a sense, to me, how to reprogram ourselves, which is coming into us, to our society. But if you live with this concept that I'm saying, it is in Swedenborg is actually backing it up. If you live with what I'm saying first, yeah. And then
which is what I'm going to talk about now. How do we reprogram?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Inherited evil can only be dispersed in people who are being regenerated. 313, Swedenborg says, nor is inherited evil dispersed and rendered harmless except with people who are being regenerated by the Lord. This anyone can recognise if he has paid the matter any attention at all from the fact that the evil inclinations of parents are so noticeable in children, etc., etc. Just see if I can find another... This tendency and proneness to evils, which is transmitted from parents to their children and descendants, can only be broken down by a person being born anew by the Lord, with the Lord's self, a process called regeneration. Without this, not only does the tendency remain unbroken, but it is reinforced by a succession of parents becoming more prone to evils, and eventually to every kind of evil. That is why the Jews are still copies of their ancestor Judah, who married a Canaanite woman and fathered three lines of a descent, etc., etc., etc. This heredity has become so amplified in the course of time that the Jews are unable to embrace the Christian religion. So that's what he said. But in fact, at the point where the Lord had to re-enter the world, hereditary evil had actually built up to such an extent that it could go no further. The world was so evil, we're told in the writings at that point, that God had to intervene. And then he began the process of, which we continue on today, of actually dispersing those evils that had built up through the inheritance. It's always been a very interesting thing to me, the idea that in the post-Roman world, after the Lord had come and died, and then the Roman Empire collapsed, in that world from about, I think, about 300 AD onwards, people actually lived in a world that, where progress was going backwards. We are, in our world, we are used to the idea of progress going ever forwards. And in Jesus, and before Jesus' time, they were also used to that sense of progress going forwards, things being invented, things being created. But after the Roman Empire fell, because I believe the Roman Empire was probably set up for the sole purpose of allowing the Lord to come into the world, after that fell, for almost 1,000 years, basically progress went backwards. And it wasn't until the Renaissance and the Enlightenment that actually began to turn around. And it's interesting to ask yourself, well, we know the Lord reversed the process, but we seem to fall into a hole before we could kind of climb out again that through that process. What did that? What was that process? What was happening in that process that caused us?
Sorry, I can't help myself. I reckon this group here that I'm sitting with, so many people here in this group are the incredible example of what you're talking about. The Lord has come in to the... There are fourth generation Swedenborgians here, and I'll bet that even their relatives go back further. And it's like the Lord, these people, the ancestors of many people sitting here, have allowed the Lord to work through them, and that's passed on to generation to generation. And you're now, in my opinion, have in this room like some of the most incredible human beings probably on this bloody planet. And that's only because...
Don't stop.
But, you know, I really think the Dark Ages were a kind of historical dark night of the soul.
They are.
Which we all go through when often soon after... We are. You know, without the regeneration process begins within us. We often go through a kind of dark
wave.
But darkness is in the dark. You can be in the dark and the light, the same. Okay.
Psalm 139.
And this ties up with what Martin first. Sorry, what
David Miller
started today to me. It's like. The ideas, this is all about good, sound, solid ideas. If Swedenborg and the Lord came in and were able to bring truth and goodness direct from the Lord and then feed it back up into the falsities that were in the world and the spiritual world, again, it shows to me, anyway, how incredibly important it is that there is on this earth people that have correct ideas and understandings that can feed them out. And my personal understanding is even the spirits with us in this room are learning now, then, if what David is saying, which makes sense to me, spirits are at this very moment gaining by the conversations we're having.
Okay, finally, final facts about inherited evil. Hereditary evil is... No, that's all right. That's all right, Kirk. Don't you worry. Hereditary evil is inherited differently from the father and the mother. From the father, it is internal or inmost. From the mother, it is external or outermost. And here's...
Internal.
Here's where I was trying to look at the... mechanics of male and female generation to show you how, you know, there's some of that in the actual correspondences of the physical process. So what does this mean? Well, what in fact it means is that inherited evil from the father, which is internal, cannot be seen. Therefore, it cannot be dealt with. So, what we have inherited, this is what the writings say, what we have inherited from our father, we cannot deal with. It remains with us. We pass it on to our children. What we have inherited from our mother, is it more external? And that is where the work is for us. It is in dealing with that. Now, don't get too depressed about that. Because obviously, I have three daughters. So my internal inherited evil will be passed on to them. I think that's right. But then they will make my internal inherited evil external to their children. I think that's right. So that then gives my grandchildren the opportunity of seeing evil and dealing with evil that I could never deal with. And so there's a fascinating back and forth.
I would tie that in with the scientific and understood thing of not marrying close relatives.
Okay.
So that, which even in Aboriginal life is a well-developed thing.
Taboo.
Further away you marry, the greater the richness of the genetic situation. And I think I picked that up from what you just said.
It also comes out in the whole area of what we call recessive and dominant genes. Okay, which is an area that I didn't want to go into because it was getting too complex. But yeah, genes can be recessive, almost we don't really know what they are because the characteristics are not displayed in the children, or they can. But then that recessive gene can become a dominant gene in the next generation. And so then at that point we see what was contained in that recessive gene. So for example, you might have four children with brown. In my circumstance, I have four children, three of them have brown hair, one of them's blonde, blue-eyed.
Yeah.
Okay. Neither my wife nor I are blonde or blue-eyed. My brother is blonde and blue-eyed, and she has a brother who's blonde and blue-eyed. So, you know, there's no suspicion there. But it's just a good example. When he was born, he was so blonde. His hair was almost white and his eyes were so blue. You know, and when we would carry him proudly around and show him to people, they would look at him and then look at us. Look at him again. Okay. What's the point of all of this? It's a nice thing to know, and I think that there are useful lessons in it for us. But obviously the main point of this is talking about the Lord, as the point of all the writings, and in fact the whole word, is what it says about the Lord. So let's look at that for a minute. Why did the Lord become incarnate, born as a human being into our world? Well, the writings say that there were two reasons, that he might glorify his humanity and that he might fight against the hells. Okay, so in that undertaking of those two purposes, the Lord came into our world in order that sin and evil could be fought by him. Now, here's an interesting thing which I didn't think of for a long time. I never thought of it before I got into the reading writings, and even reading the writings for a long time, it never really occurred to me until one day. That this is the problem. The problem is not, we think that the problem is God powerful enough to fight sin and evil? That's what everybody thinks the problem is. That is not the problem. The problem is sin and evil is so weak, it can't even approach God. God couldn't fight it even if he wanted to. He's just too powerful. You know, he just, and it's gone. The whole lot of it. You know, I guess all of us with it. This is the problem that God had. He is just too powerful to deal with sin and evil. In fact, many philosophies, human philosophies, have worked out, and other theologies have come to the conclusion that sin and evil doesn't even really exist. You know, even its existence, even the devils, if you can call it that, the existence of the hells comes from the fact that they draw their power, their energy, from God. They have no energy in themselves.
It's perverting the flow of the one life.
The best picture to describe that is compost. You know, if you cut off branches and leaves and things like that, you pile them all into a pile, you know, and they get hot. But it is the heat of the life breaking down in them that creates that heat. That sense that you know, it's building heat. It's actually the life breaking down and the sun shining on that compost that actually breaks it down further. So it's actually the power of God keeping the hells going. Okay. So the Lord had to come into the world, when he came into the world, he had to find a way to allow sin and evil to come into contact with him. And how did he do this? Well, he did this by inheriting external a body of external evil. Through his hereditary, inheriting external evil. And so he was born, obviously, of the Father. That was his internal, which was divine and therefore completely and utterly good. But he then had to have a human body with that inherited evil within it, and it had to be a mother, so that he could then have
the actions from the mother and work with it.
But he could then come face to face with the evil that oppressed the human race through being born into a body which came from a mother who had inherited evil. He was able. Jehovah himself, while it's covering, he took upon himself from his mother by being born from her. The nature of this human was such that it could undergo temptation, for it was defiled by hereditary evil received from his mother. But because the inmost centre of him was divine, he was able, by means of the power that was his own, to cast out that hereditary evil received from his mother. This casting out took place in succeeding stages by means of temptations until he underwent the final temptation, that on the cross, at which point he fully glorified his human that is made divine. From this one may see what is meant when it is said that the divine was inwardly present.
There's a lovely picture in something written by one of the early church fathers describing the hook in the mouth of the fish that
And it's this that you're talking about, that when you fish, you have a hook, but no fish is just going to go after a hook. It requires food. So the hook in the flesh, the fish comes after the flesh and is caught on the hook.
Mm-hmm.
And the hook is the power, the divine power within the body of Jesus Christ and the hereditary evils that he's coming into contact with. So, and that it's a really very vivid description in the early church fathers of, you know, what we're talking about.
Okay, thanks for that.
Yeah, nice.
So Jesus had to be born of a woman who was not divine, and more specifically, who was actually sinful. And I entitled my course, for some weird reason, Hereditary Evil and Immaculate Conception. And I'd never heard of Immaculate Conception. I guess I heard of it in passing, but I always thought it had to do with the Lord being born, you know, sinless. And a friend of mine actually pulled me over one day. He says, no, it's not to do with that. It's to do with Mary being born sinless. Now, Michael had a little chat with me, and we talked about the idea that Mary wasn't regarded as sinless, isn't regarded as being sinless by the Catholic. In other words, she did sin. She did sin. There were sins committed by her. I think that's what you were saying, is it, Michael?
I don't think so.
Yes, it's my understanding that Mary is not considered to be sinless.
Right. Okay. But she was born, the Catholic Church says she was born in a kind of a sinless way.
She's the mother of God.
That's right.
So I think she's, I don't know.
That's right. So the general impression that I got, and from reading Wikipedia, the Immaculate Conception is a dogma of the Catholic Church, and this is direct from Wikipedia, maintaining that the Blessed Virgin Mary was kept free from original sin from her moment of conception and was filled with the sanctifying grace normally conferred during baptism. It is one of the four dogmas of the Roman Catholic Mariology, or study of Mary. So the idea is that Mary would not pass sin on to Jesus.
Another one is the assumption of Mary,
right,
that she rose physically.
Right.
That's another of right. those tenets.
Now let me just say that the writings say some lovely things about Mary. There's a lot of other famous people in the Bible they say awful things about. But they do say some lovely things about that Mary. They think she's one of the few people in heaven that actually knows that she was the mother of God. What her role was on earth, yeah. And a lot of the other famous people in the writings are actually impersonated by other people who weren't quite as evil as the famous people themselves were. And it's quite interesting to come across this. Right. But Mary's not. Mary is the actual person who was there. If you see Mary in heaven, you know, you'll be able to know, well, that's actually Mary. But she, of course, if you have talked to her about this, she will say, well, I'm nothing special. I'm no one special, you know. I'm just a maid, just a woman who lived in Palestine 2,000 years ago.
I've moved on.
By God. And that's exactly right, because Mary really represented the rest of us, all of us, in so many ways. But specifically, she represented the need for our sin to be experienced by God in himself and dealt with through that experience. So we have some beautiful prophecies in the Old Testament. I looked and saw that there was nobody to fight. So by the power of my own arm, you know, I gained the victory. Yeah. And that prophecy is specifically speaking about the way Jesus took his internal, his divine, and used it to fight against the external. And in the process began the reversal. And of course today, we can, through processes that you can ask David about, because I don't really understand them. Also use that strength that Jesus had to overcome the inherited evil that each one of us are born with, as well as overcoming the temptations to increase that evil that we also have to struggle with. Thank you very much.
Welcome, Mark and David.
Wonderful address, and it's rather trite but very concise, and I received it on Christian radio the other day, and it is, if sin calls, it's best to hang up.
All right,
just one point. When you said right at the beginning that the sperm goes into the egg, that made me think of correspondences, and later on you also said something that made me think of it. The sperm going into the egg, and it's inside the egg, and of course we know that, it says in the writings that the soul comes from the Father, and of course the soul is the innermost part of our spirit. And the inherited tendencies to evil are internal, and of course that also corresponds with what you said right at the beginning, with the sperm going into the egg, whereas the external inherited tendencies to evil comes from the mother. So all of that seemed to gel.
I do have one quick question though. And, you know, I stepped out, so I'm not sure if you covered this. I apologize if you did. But for the female to pass on the hereditary evils, she doesn't have to have committed those sins to pass them on, right?
No,
that's
right.
So I mean, there's a difference between
she pass on or simply what she's inherited from.
Mm-hmm. Which means that Mary doesn't have to have sinned, but she had the hereditary evils.
Well, I think this is totally wrong. And I think it's very wrong.
I'm going to come in and say, it's half past ten.
Yeah, we're going to have a couple.
We really do need to actually move on privately. Otherwise, we're cutting off stuff later.
Yeah.
Very, very.